We're joined by Silky Gillison. Silky, you organised the APCCC meeting. I've got the name right now. After attending the meeting, it's a huge advantage.
Finally.
If you attend the meeting, you tend to get the name right. We really enjoyed it, didn't we, Brian?
We did. We did. Appreciate the invite.
Yeah, we appreciate that. We wanted just to talk. We've released a few podcasts, and we now wanted to release one or two. We haven't made our mind up yet on the summary on some key topics where we think some progress was made, so there was some clarity around and also some topics that were controversial. Silky, do you want to just fire away with maybe to start with that surgery radiotherapy issue? Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, because it was actually the beginning also of the program. It was about high-risk prostate cancer. And I think it's a quite interesting discussion. There was also quite heated debate between the urologists and the radiotherapists. And in reality, it was a debate between Alberto Briganti and Pete Ost to say, you know, what's the best local option for these patients with high-risk localized disease. And, you know, it was quite funny because Pete Ost, as the second speaker, was saying, oh, my conflict of interest is that I'm only citing randomized data. It was quite cool because obviously for surgery in that situation, there is mostly cohorts or registries or retrospective data available. So Peter is also, I mean, as
but to be fair, because surgery was established first, you know, that became the standard of care. And so radiotherapy came in to do randomized trial versus surgery because surgery was there first.
In reality, not. There is, until now, there's one running now, but there is no randomized trial testing surgery versus...
Sure, that's because it arrived first. It comes back to that jumping out of the plane without a parachute. You don't need to do an experiment. You know, we've gone back 50 years and you've got prostate cancer. We had surgery, you cut the prostate out. That's where we start. That was the standard of care.
Why don't we let Silky describe what the people talked about?
Okay,
before you get into silly
Brian.
Analogies.
Thank you,
you're
Brian,
welcome.
Because I don't even think that Tom was there. But you know, if you have something better... I mean, then
I'm happy to take the radiotherapist on. I'm happy to have a go.
That's very good.
Just describe the two sides of the argument and then maybe what the consensus was or wasn't at the end.
Yeah, so there was a consensus, but, you know, you can always say that may be a problem because maybe we didn't have enough urologists in the panel. So I have to be very fair with that. But, you know, the big discussion is really like what is the better thing, especially we're talking now only high-risk patients. I think we all agree that in intermediate risk patients, you can do both and it's really the same except the side effects are different, and that we in low risk localized prostate cancer we should do active surveillance. So this is really the tricky part. So the high risk patients, and there's different definitions of high risk, so probably the lower range of these high risk patients you can really do surgery, that's my opinion now, versus, you know, like in these higher risk patients, maybe you have an advantage of the combination of radiotherapy plus double hormonal agents like Stampede. So I guess, you know, that was kind of the whole discussion. So what is better? And the problem in reality for the surgery is that we don't have for the moment really trials in a very high risk population where they combine the surgery with systemic treatment. So that these are running now, and then hopefully, you know, with these new trials we can reach equipoise. But what Pete Ost also said, so why would you do a double hit, right? So why would you do both? Because mostly in the patients with high risk prostate cancer that you operate, you already say this will be a part of a multimodality treatment where then there is also radiotherapy added.
A couple of questions from me, Silky. So when you say double hit, you mean surgery and radiotherapy, not
exactly.
Surgery and hormone therapy. So it's essentially triple therapy. Why
exactly.
Do the triple therapy?
So why doing two local therapies? You know, that was Pete's argument.
Yeah.
When you can reach probably the same with only one.
And then my second question was, you insinuated that there's sort of high risk and super high risk. And you also kind of gave the impression that high risk was a moving definition. Can you just give your definition or your consensus group's definition of what high risk look like and what this super high risk group is like? And what's the risk of death of prostate cancer in these two groups?
So, I mean, I don't have to define that, but there is different definitions. So there's the NCCN definitions that already have included a very high risk. I guess the problem is that a lot of the older trials have been done with high risk patients, like defined in, you know, a bit more broad way to have enough accrual. But the patients who have a really high risk, they have a quite high risk also of dying from prostate cancer. So it depends on the age, it's age dependent. But if they're young patients, their risk of dying of prostate cancer is almost as high as dying from other diseases. If they are more than 70, 75, of course, the dying of other diseases starts growing. So it's depending on the age.
So, Sookie, the argument, just to go back a step for radiation, is always, to me, the leaning towards it has always been that combined modality therapy, especially now that we have sort of more intense hormone therapy, right? Whereas there's never been data, to my knowledge, that hormones adds to surgery, correct?
Yes, exactly. So there were some trials, but there were small trials, or, you know, they were inclusive and not conclusive. And the other problem is, as we said, you know, if you go to the lower range of the high-risk low-class prostate cancer patients, they tend to die from other causes. So the prostate cancer-related mortality is not so high. So there was, so I think, you know, that you really have to select the patients really well. But yeah, I agree totally with you. And now two trials are running. And I guess, you know, if you really select for the very high-risk patients and you add also like maximal hormonal therapy to the surgery, we may see very interesting results.
So, Sookie, there was a debate. It was heated. Was there a consensus?
So, yes, in our votings, there was a consensus to go for radiotherapy with hormonal treatment. But again, to be honest, I mean, if there would have been maybe more urologists in the panel, that could have looked a bit different.
And what was the vote? Was there a percentage? Was it binary? Was it radiation or surgery? Were there, I don't know, some more nuanced options?
So, yeah, I think, I can't remember now exactly. So it was radiotherapy plus ADT, radiotherapy plus ADT plus abiraterone, like, you know, like in Stampede, or surgery as part of a multimodality treatment. And they're like, if you combine the two radiotherapy options, there was consensus to do that.
So radiotherapy preferred over surgery in this high-risk population, in unselected high-risk patients, but the caveat that it's possible that in a different voting environment with a different proportion of surgeons and radiotherapists, the results might be different.
Exactly. And here was also a lot of oncologists, I think, that tend to think or ask themselves, what is the added value of surgery in a situation like that?
So sure. Just before we finish, you said there wasn't any data for adjuvant hormone therapy after surgery. Is there any reason why adjuvant hormone therapy wouldn't be effective after surgery in the way it is after radiotherapy? Or is it just because we haven't done the studies, we don't know? Or is it because there is some theoretical problem?
So there is a theoretical thought that the radiotherapy and the hormonal agents may be more than just synergistic. So they probably add on even more. So that seems to be the case. But, you know, I don't think it means that ADT added to radiotherapy to surgery wouldn't work, right? In a high-risk population that has a high risk of systemic relapse.
Sookie, so that sounds like one exciting area of debate. There was also
They also discussed about the lymph nodes. So that was quite interesting as well. So if you do the surgery, should you take the lymph nodes out? And there's a big regional differences. So I think some countries in London, I heard they usually don't take
the
lymph nodes out.
No, we don't take
the lymph
nodes out.
In Manchester, they do.
Right.
So in a lot of other countries like Italy, they clearly do. The Germans do. So I don't know about the Americans, to be honest. So Brian, you have to help us with that.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably more institution dependent, right?
It's possible.
This is just prognostic, isn't it? I mean, removing lymph nodes in pretty much every cancer, because it's micrometastatic disease and you don't know how many are involved, it's very hard to cure patients with lymphadenectomy unless you've got sort of a way of microdissecting exactly which lymph nodes have cancer. And so it tends to be a prognostic rather than a predictive kind of, it's not a curative intervention. Am I right or I got that completely wrong?
No, you got that right. And it's like in melanoma and everyone, right? Like breast cancer and so on. Right?
This has not happened before.
Yeah, so it was a good guess. No, I guess good because guess. It's the same in melanoma. And
scratching around the dark.
Right. So Jochen Wolz gave a really fascinating talk. You know, they do it as a staging. And maybe, you know, that has a sense, but it has also side effects like, So it's a bit, you know, it's quite debated. There's never done a trial, but now Tom is coming with the parachute again. Anyway, but you know, usually
I know you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
As much as you hate to admit it,
one
I know you understand.
And the other issue that it gets into is that if you have a positive node, you know, then what do you do, right? With very old data about hormones and things like that. You know what I mean? So that's, it sort of leads you down a road that you're not really sure what the right path is, you know, you're not really sure what the right route.
Yeah,
so.
Brian, you're absolutely right. I guess there is some retrospective data that if you have more than three or more lymph nodes, then maybe that would be, you know, they seem to profit from adjuvants therapy. But again, and then there's this super old data from Messing, who just gave ADT to everyone, that I think nobody will do nowadays. But we don't have good randomized data in that situation. But again, you know, there was really a lot of discussion about that because the EU guidelines have now taken it out to be like really clearly to be done. And that was quite interesting discussion as well. So if I can say, it's just also because we now have PSMA PET, right?
Right.
So you do a PSMA PET, it's negative. So is it worth taking all the lymph nodes out, right? But then there is data that the PSMA PET in that situation is not so fantastic. So, you know, like when you look at you take lymph nodes out, you have had a PSMA PET before.
A false negative.
The false negative rate is quite high. So, yeah, it was quite interesting.
I've got to move you on. We're trying to get through three topics. And I'm very anxious because I know there was we may have to, but otherwise we're going to have to split it into two. So there was There was a second controversy. There was a second debate that was also caused. There was some heat in a second debate. What's that second topic you wanted to talk about?
So in reality, it was about genetic evaluation a bit in general. So there was a very, very good talk, I think, from Heather Cheng, who spoke about germline testing. So it's worth looking at that. So in which patients you should do germline testing. But there was not such a heated debate about that. It was more like the usual topic that you already have had also in the podcast. About the BARP inhibitors,
Do you want to talk about germline testing first?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that first.
Yeah, if you have time. So
yeah, of course.
We have to do the second one anyway.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was quite nice, you know, because so first of all, I think it was really a very good talk to understand why you should do germline testing, and we had votings about it. You know, like, should you do it in high-risk localized? Should you do it in metastatic hormone-sensitive? Should you do it in metastatic castration-resistant disease? And the panel was quite clear to do it in metastatic CRPC and a metastatic hormone-sensitive disease, but not so clear.
What are you testing and why?
So this depends really from where you are. So there's a whole panel that is also given by NCCN, that is the broader panel that probably most Europeans maybe do a bit less. It's mostly about BRCA, but it's also about a lot of other genes. And, you know, the idea is really to look for familiarity and, you know, like we have seen that also in patients with metastatic cancer, there's quite a lot of patients who have a mutation, any mutation that is a germline mutation, about 15 to 20%, what is quite high.
So yeah, in the US, the recommendation is all metastatic patients. I think we've found we don't have enough capacity in our genetic counselors to do that. So yeah, we're kind of using that and saying, okay, well, you know, let's select out a subset of those patients, you know, based on family history, you know, the usual things. Is that what's happening globally? I mean, I don't know if that's a US thing or not.
I think it's a global thing, to be honest. So I have to say, in Switzerland, we have genetic counselors. I understood from Oliver Sartor that in the States, there's also the idea that you can do a course or a certificate, and then, you know, you can do the first step of the genetic counseling, and then you can do the tests, and then a real genetic counselor can speak, or like a more experienced one, mm-hmm. After the test results. I don't know how it is in England, but I heard that also in England, it's difficult to get the counseling. The tests are difficult.
Yeah, I think it's difficult for a number of reasons. One of which is I'm not yet totally bought into why we're doing it. Why exactly are we doing germline testing on men in their 70s and 80s who have got metastatic cancer?
It's probably much more about the families.
Yeah.
So it doesn't
affect their care necessarily, although
this isn't about helping these patients. It's about knowing whether or not their families have got BRCA mutations in the same way as going down the same route as we have with breast cancer. Is that right?
No, it's reality two things, right? It's like, so you can help the patient because now we have treatments. Like, let's speak about BRCA because it's the easiest one. So we have treatments, so we can offer him treatments.
But you can do those BRCA tests on the tumor. You don't have to do it on the germline material.
But that's true. But anyway, if you do the germline first, you found it.
Not everyone with a germline is going to have a tumor base. So you've got to do both anyway, haven't you?
So, yeah, that was our questions were about that. Should you do germline testing? Should you do somatic testing first, how it was in Switzerland, and then only do germline when you find something? Or should you do from the beginning germline and somatic testing?
And what was the answer to your consensus question on that?
So, that was quite different from, you know, when we asked that for high risk localized disease. Then we had, a mix all over. So, but 38% would do nothing. So no genetic evaluation. 30% would do germline testing, and the rest was split between the other two. When you go to the metastatic hormone sensitive disease, there's much less no, 17% no. And a lot of people would also do first the germline testing, and then, just would do both the germline and the somatic testing. And in mCRPC, even more people would do both. So that was 70% about, if I remember right.
70% doing both somatic and germline in advanced disease?
Yes, in mCRPC.
That's not happening in a global perspective. Our prostate cancer patients who come through our clinic, you know, we're just beginning to get into the place where we're testing for BRCA and HRR, but we're not in a place where we're routinely offering germline testing on our patients. We're some distance from that, and it sounds like an aspirational rather than a practical answer.
I mean, yes. So the panelists, we said that let's assume everything is available. So what they then do in the real practice, I don't know, but we know that you miss about 10% of patients if you do only one or the other tests. So you can find some more patients who could profit from a BARP inhibitor if you would do it both ways.
But you're right, Tom. I mean, I think some of this is what resources do you have in your institution, in your team, right? Because these are big conversations mm-hmm. with patients and testing and who's takes a fair amount of resource, human and otherwise, to do this. So I think, as Silky said, there's the aspirational, if I could just snap my fingers and make it happen, versus the practical in a busy clinic, like how do I prioritize and get done? And maybe next visit I'll talk about germline, et cetera. I know, you know, in a busy clinic, those are considerations.
Silky, should we move on very briefly to the HRR story? Because there was a debate about which patients should receive PARP inhibition. And I know we've covered that before, but where did you get to in your consensus statement? Did you follow the BRCA only population, or was it the HRR population?
So we asked this question. So we asked the question. So I think it was quite good consensus that if you have a BRCA2 mutation, you should treat with the combination of an AR inhibitor and a BARP inhibitor. So there was consensus. So people buy into that. There was also quite clear consensus that you would not give this combination in unselected patients. But, you know, we dug also a bit deeper in the whole thing, and we asked about the more frequent other mutations or alterations. And I think one thing that was quite nice, and that was something that Johan de Bono said, he did a really fantastic talk about dissecting all these alterations and when a BARP inhibitor could be helpful. And he said BALB2 should be called BRCA3, because BALB2, the patients with the BALB2 mutations are probably the ones that respond as well as the BRCA2 mutated patients. I think that was something very catchy, so you can keep that in your mind. With all the other mutations, it's more complex, and it's very difficult. In reality, it's more difficult than we think, and it's also more difficult than what comes out of a commercial test. I don't know, Brian, if you're using them.
Well, so it sounds like it was consensus on the BRCA2, consensus on the non-HRR, but the non-BRCA HRR is where you sort of get into the weeds and there's probably discrepancy. Is that a fair summary?
That's a fair summary. So even BRCA1, the data is not as strong as for BRCA2. It's also much less frequent, of course. And then BALB2, after the talk from Johan, probably even more panelists would have voted for that. So our question was actually phrased like, would you use it like in BRCA2 patients? Would you use it, but maybe in a later line? Or would you not use it? So I think, you know, that is really something that's quite complex in the clinic. And then, you know, it was quite fun because Noel Clark said to Johan, yeah, you can do that in your super lab, but it's very complicated to get, you know, all this information that Johan does in his own lab, you know, about the biallelic loss or loss of function or not, in a normal surrounding, let's put it this way.
Silky, we're at a crossroads now. We can call it a day here, and we can talk a little bit in a separate podcast to follow this, or we can keep going. What would you like to do?
I do whatever you like to do. You're the boss.
Let's keep going, Tom. Let's keep going.
Okay, right. You can cut it. You can cut out whatever you want.
We don't know how to edit.
Don't know.
You don't know how to edit. Okay.
Silky, got a question for you. You changed the methodology of the meeting a little bit, and that you're now asking the questions before. And so the panelists are not given the opportunity to listen to the talk before they vote. With hindsight, which is the best way of doing this? Because clearly, as you said previously, listening to someone, you know, talk about what they think and then voting afterwards sounds from a distance more appealing than people voting in their rooms before the meeting and then having the discussion.
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, you know, we were thinking about that. In reality, we changed it because of COVID. And so because then we couldn't do the conference live with everyone. So we thought maybe we tried the survey, and the survey worked very well. So there's plus and minuses as always. So the plus for doing the survey is you can have much more panelists. And people can have a bit more time to think about the answers. The negative side is, and we discussed that, some people said, you should rediscuss maybe some of the, rewrote some of the questions. But, you know, I think we will not do that.
Did you groan there? Was that a groan?
Hmm?
I think Brian just groaned. Yeah. Yeah, bro. When you said revote, bro, I just groaned. I just felt
well. It sounds like when you revote, you have a lot of questions, right? So if you're voting and revoting, sometimes it's just too much, right? Sometimes there's too much.
I hoped when we did that Brexit thing, I wanted us to revote, but no one else agreed with me. Apparently,
a lot of groans.
I would have agreed with you. No, yeah. Brian, I think you're right. So, and also we would expect our experts to be experts, and you know, I mean, then it's kind of weird when we just like revote and do it again. But I mean, we discussed about that. I think we also discussed, Tom, and I think this is something, but your input is very, very valuable, of course. You know,
or not.
That we would look, you know, we do next time a survey with the participants before the session and after the session and see if something changes there.
Brian and I are thinking of having a bit of a sort of a similar thing in our Euromigos meeting in Nashville this year, asking one or two questions. And so these tips are helpful for us. I was going to move on, if we may. I've got one more kind of logistics questions I want to ask towards the end. But we the third topic you wanted to talk about was PSMA. And I saw there was a video on Twitter and a song the Village People, which the cowbell was involved. I thought it was brilliant. But what generated that musical interlude?
I don't know. You're probably too young, both of you, to know YMCA, that song.
Of course we're not too young.
I've actually taken part in that, and I was dressed as the builder. Indian. Was it the builder or the policeman? I think it was the police, but I can't remember, one or the other.
I hope there's no
the policeman
pictures.
And the builder. Yeah. No, and of course, and Daniel Heine, he's an clinical oncologist from Norway. He was saying, you know, what PSMA and YMCA sound so similar. And then, started to do, and it's actually true, right?
Amazing.
And then so he started to do a song. First, just a slide with the, you know, Oliver Sartor and Ken Herrmann and Michael Hoffman and everyone on there. And then, you know, I said, why don't we do a song? And then he said, oh, yeah. And then Joe O'Sullivan did the lyrics and they did a song and then they did a dance.
Do you want to sing a little of that song on the podcast?
No. Who wants to listen to it? It's on Twitter.
I see. All right, Tom, are we doing the last topic?
Yes, we are. So we talked to me a little bit about the controversies around that topic and where we got to. Brian and I talked about PSMA4 and all the survival bits, and we've covered this. Where did you get to in your consensus document around this issue?
Yeah, so that was quite interesting. So the question, so the voting was very, very clear that for docetaxel or chemotherapy fit patients, after only one RP, there was consensus not to give lutetium, but to give docetaxel.
So that's a rejection of the PSMA4 study.
Exactly.
And so why is that?
In chemo, I don't know. I didn't, you know, they voted like that. So, I think it's quite clear. It's chemotherapy fit patients. That was not the population exactly in PSMA4. PSMA4 is not published. We have seen it reported, we haven't seen it published. So I was surprised, to be totally honest with you. But it was
based on the
very clear
data, the proven survival for chemo, and we don't know the full data for PSMA4 yet.
It may be, okay. Very well be. In the end, I will not know why, but yeah, to my surprise, it was quite a clear result for docetaxel.
Interesting.
And on the other hand, the result for lutetium giving it after an RP and docetaxel was very clear for lutetium and not for cabazitaxel, even if also 20% voted for cabazitaxel. So quite interesting.
And Silky, my last question around this is around that triplet third therapy first line. We've had PIECE1 and we've had other trials. Stampede, looking at triplet therapy versus doublet therapy.
Oh, Tom, can I interrupt you for once?
Yeah, yes, of course. You don't have to ask. You just dive in. If you want to interrupt me, you don't have to ask.
No, because I think there was much more interesting stuff also in the PSMA, actually.
Oh, yeah, keep going.
Yeah, because, you know, we are talking a lot about these results, but you know, what was really clear from the PSMA targeting session on Saturday morning, that we actually don't really know how to best optimize radioligand therapy with lutetium PSMA. And it was quite interesting because it was not clear how really to select the patients. So also that was a question. And it was quite of, you know, a third who said, yeah, we should also add an FDG PET and so on. So the selection.
Why then, FDG PET?
Because that was in the, that was done in the therapy trial, the Australian trial. So they say, you know, you can select the patients better, not only using PSMA PET, but also using an FDG PET. But if someone is in lesions, low on the PSMA, very high on the FDG PET, this is probably a very good sign not to treat this patient with lutetium PSMA.
Two PET scans for these patients.
Yeah, the Australians do that.
Sounds quite a lot to me.
Yeah,
for biomarkers that have been really not proven, two PET scans sounds a bridge too far.
Yeah, the Australians seem to do that regularly. To really, and I think, you know, you exclude the patients who have a very low probability to do well on lutetium PSMA.
So that's FDG high, PSMA low.
Exactly.
We believe they're the non-responders. And is that just out of retrospective analysis of prospective studies, or is that generated off, you know, alpha allocation, or is this just very speculative?
That was a randomized phase 2 study that used as eligibility criteria the
both
two
pets.
Yeah. Wow. And they do really badly. So that we also know that, because they were excluded, but they were followed. So their oncological outcomes are much poorer than either the patients treated with lutetium or cabazitaxel.
So where did you get to as a group? Because I can't imagine that most people voted to do two PET scans on most patients. So where did you get to from this biomarker perspective? Is it PSMA directed therapy for lutetium or not?
So, you know, it's just interesting because the Australians believe in this double. Tom Hope from the States was saying, you know, as you said, this is much too much, and we actually really only need the FDG PET in very, very singular patients, exceptional cases. You know, we didn't try to reach a consensus, but it was just clear that we need much more work on that. The same thing is also for monitoring, right? So how do you monitor these patients on lutetium PSMA? Should you really use another PSMA PET? It probably doesn't make so much sense. So all the nuclear medicine guys say you should use a SPECT. Except that I think we as clinicians, we don't really know how to read a SPECT, and we sometimes don't get them. They look very blurry. So, you know, it's so much more that we should really discuss together, and maybe we have to build up more trust and so on. You know, Stefano Fonti was saying, now we have all this power as nuclear medicine doctors. Now we have also a lot of responsibility. And I guess we as clinicians have to build up trust, you know. So if they say there is a bone met, we probably have to believe in it, even if we can't make difference between a false negative and a false positive result. And I think, you know, that was quite interesting because he said, so why is this question, you know, turning up if you should use a patient, you know, like should treat a patient who has PSMA positive disease, so metastatic disease, but in a conventional imaging, non-metastatic disease, why are you asking this question? Of course you should treat him as a metastatic patient. And that was quite interesting, you know, I mean, just from a philosophical point of view, of course all our trial data comes from the times where we had only conventional imaging.
I think that's one of the major issues in prostate cancer, looking from a distance, is you've done all your tests on one population using a series of tests that define your eligibility criteria, and now you've got a new, what appears to be a more sensitive but a different test, and you're applying those original data sets to these newer populations.
Exactly.
And that may or may not make sense.
Yeah, and, we had a same question in the localized disease. So sorry to come back now. You know,
it's okay. We're only doing one podcast, so people.
Fantastic. So yeah, so we switching back okay. to the real, real. sorry, early stages, where Declan Murphy gave a very entertaining talk about digital rectal exams. And, you know, our TNA...
Those words aren't often used in the same sentence. Entertaining and DRE, but go ahead.
No, and, you know, the T in the TNM classification is in reality given by your DRE, mm-hmm. not by the MRI. But now we are doing all MRIs. So now, next, that's the same question, right? So now we have T3 in an MRI, but the digital rectal examination says T2. So how are you treating these patients, right? Again, all the data is based on the classical TNM stage. And now we have much better tools to stage patients, not only with the PSMA PET, but also with the parametric MRI. But all our data are coming from another generation. And I think that's quite interesting and probably have to change the TNM classification.
Silky, I'm going to draw you back, if I can, to yes. the first line metastatic question.
Yes.
What consensus did you come to around treatment of first line metastatic disease?
So you speaking specifically about the high volume now, about the triplets?
Well, or... I got the impression from the meeting and speaking to people, which I have to say was mostly done in restaurants and bars afterwards, that there was a real sort of the volume of disease issue, whether it's three or five lesions. I didn't get clarity around that, but I did get clarity around people having a really good feel for that volume of disease being a defining issue about how we treat patients as well as the synchronous and metachronous disease. And that seems to have been widely adopted. And there does seem to be a consensus around not all patients needing triplet upfront therapy.
Yes. So that was quite clear. So I think, but that's not so new. I think most people in high volume, de novo disease now really, we didn't ask the question, to be honest, like completely, but so there seems to be quite a consensus to, if someone is fit enough, of course, to do that, to do the triplet systemic therapy. Most people would not add also the local radiotherapy, but that was another question. But for the other stages, you know, where we are a bit more insecure, so the synchronous, so the de novo low burden disease, there was like half split, if I remember right, between only to give it to selected patients or not to give it. In the metachronous low burden was clear consensus not to give the triplet systemic therapy. And in the metachronous high burden, a third of the panelists would give it to the majority of patients and half of the panelists to yes, but only in selected patients.
So the synchronous metachronous is really coming into play as much as the volume.
Yes.
Right, which makes sense from a biological standpoint.
Even more, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even those patients with high risk disease, there isn't a clear consensus that they're all getting triplet therapy.
High volume, you mean?
High volume. So high volume, synchronous disease, not even that population, everyone was getting triplet therapy.
We didn't ask the question specifically, unfortunately, I found that I was so as always, Tom always finds the weak spots on everything. But
I apologize.
It's like, yeah, but you're right. I was like asking, why didn't we put that? But anyway, we asked a more general question, like, what are you doing in patients with high burden? How many do you give triplet therapy? And so there was more than half. So the majority would give it to the majority of patients in the high burden disease. Since, to be honest, high volume metachronous is a very rare disease stage. So it seems, it's the majority. It was 55% or something, but it's not all. A lot of patients would only give it to selected patients, even if they were all chemotherapy fit.
One last question is, and I don't know if you mentioned this, but was there discussion around incorporation of PSMA PET findings into the decision around volume and need for chemotherapy? Because people walk in now, obviously, with PSMA PET even more than conventional imaging. And obviously, to Tom's earlier point, you know, the studies didn't use PSMA PET when determining volume, et cetera, et cetera. So was there discussion around that?
Yes. So there was, Dana showed a very, a very nice patient case where this patient was low volume on conventional imaging, young patient, Gleason 9, yeah. So very aggressive disease. They did the PSMA PET and he was full of metastasis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that sense, yes, you know, as she said, you know, you're probably more prone to give docetaxel mm-hmm. than in the low volume stage. And also, you would not give metastasis-directed therapy if you find right. out that someone has so many metastases. So yes, it has a lot, I think, you know, kind of a lot of influence on our decisions.
Silke, I'd like to thank you on behalf of me and Brian for inviting us. We really enjoyed it. It was really nice to meet the prostate team, and it was obviously a huge meeting with over 1,000 people. I think everyone I spoke to really enjoyed the meeting. What happens next with the APCCC?
So we have a new, like, kind of APC diagnostics in a year from now, in February. So because Stefano Fonti and Ken Herrmann, two nuclear medicine specialists, asked me if they could do under the umbrella of the APCCC something more really into imaging, but also other diagnostics like molecular markers and so on. And they will do that next year. And our next meeting, like the general one, will be in 2026, end of April, beginning of May. And I hope to see you both there.
I'm up for it.
We'd love to be there. Thanks for congratulations.
Thanks for joining us. Terrific meeting.
Thank
see you.
You
soon.
Cheers. Bye. Bye-bye.